The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists annual convention and scientific sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the annual clinical assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Hepatobiliary scintigraphy in patients with clinically perplexing abdominal complaints is presented by Dr. Mark Tulchinski.
Thank you, Jim, for this kind introduction and welcome to this session. We're going to be talking about scintigraphy or nuclear medicine imaging, and we will focus today on just one very, very small area that we cover, and that is abdominal pain, evaluation of abdominal pain. And even that we will not cover anywhere to the full degree. But without any further ado, I would like to start and at least get you introduced to what we do in nuclear medicine. If we can have the next slide. Do you know where the... Okay. Why don't we just review what we might cover today, given the time, and we will start with just explaining what nuclear medicine is, and then we will define indications for hepatobiliary scintigraphy. And those are the topics in general. So what is nuclear medicine? I'm sure that most of you have either heard or used nuclear medicine. And I don't know how often you thought about why is it nuclear and, you know, what is it all about, besides maybe one test that you were sending the patient for. But it's a medical specialty that utilizes radioactive isotopes or pharmaceuticals labeled with radioisotopes, called radiotracers sometimes, sometimes radiopharmaceuticals. Those are the terms that we throw around. And this is done for either diagnostic and or sometimes therapeutic indications. In fact, nowadays, we use the same radiotracer in different amounts and labeled with different radioisotope to accomplish both. The first one will go and diagnose where the problem is, and the second one, carrying a different amount of energy, will go and irradiate it therapeutically. We call it today theranostics. So that's a new term. With all that being said, I haven't said anything that explains nuclear, right? So you probably, I hope you're sitting and wondering, so why, you know, somebody decided to call it nuclear medicine? What's nuclear about it? Does anyone in the audience happen to have an answer? I'm going to try to have you help me along, because sometimes I get things either confused or forgotten, and amongst all of us, I'm sure we'll remember. Does anyone have a suggestion as to why is it nuclear? What is so nuclear? For example, osteopathic medicine. I was wondering until I looked it up, why is it osteo, which is in Latin, bone? And it turns out that A.T. Stills decided to call it osteopathic based on a bone being the core of the human body, of the whole. And so that being said, osteopathic now makes a bit more sense, but you still kind of have to explain it. And I'm sure that people come up to you and ask, you know, why is it osteopathic? You correct the broken bones. You know, I thought there was an orthopod. So anyone helps me here with explaining why is it nuclear? Well, if not, then I will take a brief moment and try to highlight that. So just like you folks deal with the core of the human body, the bone structure, and try to line it up in a perfect harmony, we look at the core of the atom. So atom has a nucleus, that's the core, and there it is. Niels Bohr and Ernest Rutherford proposed this very, very simplistic, as we know today, but in 1913, it was a fairly complicated model of the atom. And there is the nucleus, and electrons around, you know, rotate around it as they imagined it. Now we can actually see it. And so this is the basic model of the atom. The most smallest of the cores is the nucleus there. And of course, even within the nucleus, there are neutrons and positrons and all those boring things that we don't often think about. So let's get rid of this labeling and let's think about it a little bit more. So the orbits that electrons rotate around that also have stable orbits, and then there are higher energy orbit, the one that was blinking, and it's in dashed line. So you can actually get one of those electrons rotating around up to a higher energy orbit, but you gotta give it some energy. So let's see if we can do that. There are some tubes that can charge the electron with extra energy, and there it goes. And then that electron will jump up to the higher valency or the higher orbit, and it will carry that energy with it. But like everything else in life, including human beings, will like to get back to the stable state. You know, you probably remember your teenage years, and looking back, I mean, that was kind of fun. There was a lot of energy spent, but today you're probably in a different situation. You might be in a family unit, as we call it, having children and so forth. So that's a more of a stable human existence as we know it. And so that electron will also produce that energy and will release it. And there it goes, that red, boom, out it goes. And then it loses it that way and drops down back to the same orbit, closer to the nucleus. And so that energy emission we call a photon, and that photon is the X-ray. So X-ray is what the X-ray tube produces in the radiology department. So it comes from the shell of the nucleus, the electron shell. And that's pretty superficial, if you will. Now let's take another look at that same Bohr's model. And if I haven't bored you yet to death, I'm gonna persevere just for a few more minutes. Let's get rid of those annotations. And sometimes what you have is an isotope that is the same element chemically, the same structure, but has more or less neutrons, or just simply carrying extra energy. And you see that nucleus pulsating right there, it's just carrying too much energy. It needs to get rid of it. How does it do that? There are a number of ways. One of those ways is to emit that energy in the form of a ray. And there it is. So you emit that ray, and then, whoops, it comes stable. We call it decay. That event is a decay. So the active pulsating, that extra energetic, or what we call metastable nucleus, becomes stable again. By the way, did anyone notice I keep saying nucleus, nucleus, nucleus here, nucleus there? Well, if you think of it, that is why we are nuclear medicine, because that emission, amongst others, is the gamma ray. So gamma emission comes from the nucleus and thus nuclear medicine. You might want to walk downstairs to your radiologist and say, why is nuclear medicine called nuclear medicine? That would be a trick question. If you have something to carry out of this lecture, maybe that'll be the little fun you can poke at them. And I can bet you they won't come up with the answer. Try it when you get back. And then you will go into this fairly simplistic explanation why nuclear medicine is called nuclear medicine, and maybe he or she will look at you a little different next time you walk into the radiology department. Maybe they'll run out of the department altogether. So let's talk about scintillation, and I will explain what scintillation means. It has a root, and there it is outlined. The root is scinti. That's a Latin, and that Latin stands for scintilla. That's the word, and means spark, as in a spark of light. So scinti, or scintillator, that square ahead of this contraption, is a crystal. And when it receives a photon of energy, particular gamma energy, some of them will act by producing a spark of light. And that's why sometimes you hear an expression, oh, that was a scintillating event, meaning there was a lot of new information or knowledge, and knowledge we always equate with light. That's why it was the Enlightenment period, because there was a lot of new knowledge born. So, and scintillating crystal, the reason I'm showing it to you, I want you to understand how we get our images as well. And this is a simplest of pieces within our camera. And since we're imaging gamma rays, that will be gamma camera. So when you come into the radiology or nuclear medicine department, whichever way it's structured in your facility, you will see a camera that takes nuclear medicine images, and that will be a gamma camera. It will capture those gamma emissions. So scintigraphy, the same root, is the scan obtained using this method of imaging. And when you read a report, sometimes it says there is no scintigraphic evidence of such and such. It means on the imaging done using this methodology, there was no evidence for what you were looking was present. Or there was evidence, or there was scintigraphic evidence of such and such. It means that they did actually depict it using this methodology. So if you get that gamma ray into this crystal, so you saw that little gamma ray, boom. What will happen is there is that scintillation event. There is a light photons, the light, the spark of light that will be produced there. That spark of light then will be processed through this maze of dinodes and ends up on an anode, it's all labeled on there, as a pulse of electricity because it knocks out a primary electron, one electron per one photon that will get multiplied by that schema displayed and eventually ends up in producing an electric pulse. And there goes the pulse, that red thing. And once it gets to the computer, that gets counted. So one gamma photon hitting that scintillator crystal, one count. So you can imagine who was my favorite character on Sesame Street when my children were growing up. Exactly. Von Count. So that was my absolutely favorite character. Must have been the first nuclear medicine physician ever. Mr. or Dr. Von Count. We count every scintillation event. We count every photon the best we can for you guys when you send patients to be investigated. This is what it looks like. And behind, that's a photomultiplier tube, a basic element of a gamma camera. And behind it, you see the picture. So how does that picture come out of that fairly trivial contraption, right? We could probably put it together. The way it goes is you put a lot of those tubes along a larger, and you see that in that purple, that is a scintillator, larger scintillator crystal, and you couple multiple those photomultiplier tubes. So if you label a brain, and you saw the picture of the brain, incidentally, on that screen behind there. So if you label the brain with something radioactive that displays, say, perfusion, blood flow in the brain, and then you put the patient down there, and all those photons will eventually end up projecting parallel to one another and depict the distribution of those radio tracers emitting the energy in the human body, specifically the brain in this case. So then they will generate that light spark. That light spark will be generated into the electric pulses, and that will paint out there for you the perfusion to the brain, or metabolism in the brain, as you would see on a PET CT. and so forth. So nuclear medicine also has very specific principles by which we do things. Like you folks have your manual manipulation. You have certain principles that you practice by. And here's our principles. They're very straightforward. Number one, the diagnostic radiotracer does not change the biology of the test subject. So when you send us a patient, whatever we give that patient is a tracer or radiotracer. That implies it just goes through without changing anything, simply depicting the physiology of whatever process that tracer mimics or simulates. So they do not harm your patients, and they do not change biochemistry. Just measure the pathophysiology or physiology of the event itself. The second principle is the diagnostic radiotracer distribute in proportion to the targeted volume. What does it mean? Well, if I take something radioactive and put it in a volume, for example, let's talk about simple diffusion. We put some radioactive red blood cells in the circulation, and they will uniformly label the entire blood pool of the human body. And that's how we do the scan called MUGA scan or ventriculogram, where we look at the chamber of the left or right ventricle for that matter, and we can image that. Also, we can synchronize it to electrocardiogram, and you can see the blood pool of that chamber pulsating in front of you because we take images synchronous with electric activity of the heart. And then you can, because the volume and the activity are proportional, we can measure the activity externally with the gamma camera, and we can trace how the volume changes and give you ejection fraction. So ejection fraction is simply the proportion of blood expelled from the left ventricle during the contraction of the initial diastolic volume. That's all it is. And the reason we can do that is not because we measure ellipsoid and emulate the actual sphere. We don't do any of that math. We just do the counts. Dr. Van Count just counts those counts within the left ventricle, and as the ventricle changes, so do the counts or activity, radioactivity, within that ventricle. So with that being said, I have about 23 minutes to cover hepatobiliary scintigraphy as it pertains to chronic abdominal pain. Essentially, we emulate the passage of bilirubin through the body. That's what we do. The radiotracer we use is, if you will, a radioactive bilirubin that will be picked up by the liver, excreted, and that brings us back to what does the liver consist of. The functional unit is the hepatic lobule. A quick reminder, this is just a little wedge, 1/4 of a large hepatic lobule. If you put a bunch of them together, a couple of million, then you get the whole liver. But essentially, it works in a very similar fashion as that little wedge. If you look here, you will notice there is the hepatic artery branch perfusing the liver, and then there is a portal vein branch that go to perfuse that wedge. And they all merge together and provide the blood for the sinusoids. Those sinusoids, they're labeled there, they bathe, if you will, the hepatocytes and eventually will drain into the central vein. And here are the hepatocytes. Did you see that? Hepatocytes pop up right there? So they're lined up along those sinusoids. And so they can extract the bad chemistry out of the body, if you will, clear the body from the byproducts, as well as they can clear one of the byproducts is the bilirubin. And that's the bilirubin that's going to be passed down into the bile, and here it is, through the canaliculi, and they will combine into the bile ducts right there. I don't know how well this projects, but in green are the bile ducts and the canaliculi come all the way up to the hepatocytes. There is also lymph that gets derived from there, and it's the Kupffer cells, those little green flat cells that you see on that drawing. Those are Kupffer cells. There are reticular endothelial system cells that derive the lymph out of there. So let's now send a radioactive tracer and see how that pans out. So technetium-99m, or metastable technetium, is one of the most useful the radioisotopes that we use to label our imaging compounds or radiopharmaceuticals. And technetium-99m, you can attach it to mebrafenin. And mebrafenin is the analog of bilirubin, and inject it intravenously. 25% of that injection will be delivered via the hepatic artery to the liver, and 75% via the portal vein. And there they go. So those are those particles coming up towards the sinusoids. Then they will be in the sinusoids, bathing those liver cells, the hepatocytes. The hepatocytes will take them up and put them in the bile. They will transport it actively into the bile. It's a complex process, but simply stated, it's a multi-drug resistance associated protein 2 that catches those particles, bilirubin and this, and put it in a bile. So besides this, we also need to know a little bit about the physiology of the liver. Let me review that quickly before we start looking at the images. And here's the gallbladder in a fasting state. So accommodation of incoming bile happens like this. Can we go to the back to the first slide again? I happen to click next. Okay. So accommodation of incoming bile. So the gallbladder is that little green ellipsoid that you see there with a little Ys sticking on it. And those Ys are the receptors. They're receptors for syncolide or CCK, or it's a the active compound that the gallbladder and the hepatobiliary tree reacts to, the CCK, cholecystokinin. So as you see, can we start this? I don't think it's starting. Maybe if we start from the prior and advance to this, yeah, it will start. Okay, it's starting. So you see the bile generating, the green stuff flowing towards the gallbladder, then the gallbladder is growing in size. That's what happens in the fasting state. So this is 4 o'clock in the morning. You see the time clock going down there below. 5 o'clock in the morning, the gallbladder gets bigger and bigger and bigger. That's how it happens. And some of it will be dripping into the duodenum. You see the drops dripping into the duodenum. And to drip into the duodenum, they have to pass by the sphincter. That's a sphincter of Oddi. So sphincter of Oddi, they have to get through the sphincter of Oddi. So if we inject the radiotracer at that point, they will go in, and some will go into the gallbladder right there, and some will go into the duodenum. And that's essentially how our radiotracer will end up in a gallbladder. So now that it's in a gallbladder, we can actually study it and do some imaging. So with that, I'm gonna skip over the next couple of slides. They're unimportant because I have actually 16 minutes to finish up with. And what I'd like to do at this point is look at the actual cases with you. Patients with chronic abdominal pain and gallbladder dysfunction is the main key, essential topic that we address with hepatobiliary scintigraphy in outpatients. That's separate. For those surgical colleagues of ours, this is the patients that you get as outpatients for routinely scheduled cholecystectomy, gallbladder removal to get rid of those biliary pains. So, however, the challenge is that there is a lack of clear definition of biliary pain to begin with. It's subjective. So inherently, it's very difficult. It's nonspecific in nature. The symptom complex is very challenging to sort out. It could be multiple other problems in the human body that would cause the same type of symptomatology. There is a limited understanding of a natural history of and pathophysiology of chronic biliary type abdominal pain. That's another big challenge. And there used to be lack of standardization in performance of what's called a CCK cholecystography, abbreviated on the slide as CCKCS. So that's a cholecystography. Now I don't have to even explain to you what that stands for because you already know what scintigraphy is and you know what CCK stands for. And then low percentage of US practices actually use the protocol recommended by our society. So when you come back, ask your nuclear medicine or radiology specialist who usually reports those tests, how do they administer the CCK or its synthetic analog, Syncolide? There are essentially very few conditions that we will sort out using this test, CCKCS. Functional gallbladder disorder and chronic calculus cholecystitis. It was initially thought, too, that we will be able to sort out what's called a sphincter of OD dysfunction. Over the past 3 years, the folks from North Carolina, leading institution in this area of sphincter OD functionality and dysfunction, therefore, has really removed that entity as being a very clear pathology. So a lot of that might be what we thought and did not work out in practice to be a real disease. But for now, let's talk about what we do know to represent real disease, and that's a functional gallbladder disorder. What does it mean? It means when you take the gallbladder out, look under the microscope, you will see nothing wrong with it, but it does not function correctly. So it's oftentimes like when you look at the X-ray and get a report, normal radiograph of the lumbar spine, but you, after manipulating the patient and feeling the patient, know that that spine is not fine. It needs to be realigned. And functional gallbladder disorder is that sort of a thing. Is nothing anatomically wrong with it, but it does not function properly. It actually contracts while the sphincter is still contracted also, and you got two pressure systems hitting against each other, which causes the biliary pain. Then there is also chronic calculus cholecystitis. That's different. When you take that gallbladder out, you find stones, sludge, polyps on the gallbladder wall, and so forth. So two distinctly different categories that we're going to be talking about. We're not going to talk much about sphincter OD dysfunction. So here is the image that we get. We get our images, what's called dynamically. It's like a cine, like a movie. But then we can put the frames in the movie in separate little frames and combine them. And for example, here on the image set, we combined all the real fast frames into 4 minute per frame images. So you see 15 images displayed, 4 minute per, so that's 60 minutes, 1 hour imaging altogether. If you look at frame one, you see good extraction. You see nothing in the blood pool above where the heart is because the liver sucked it all up. So it's an excellent liver function tracer. If you ever wonder about liver function, and you oftentimes would order liver function tests, as a matter of fact, you can't get a liver function test. The enzymes you get is the liver cells or hepatocyte injury test, if you will, but it's not liver functioning test. This is liver function test. We can actually measure the clearance rate, kind of like you measure glomerular filtration with different GFR, like creatinine. We can measure the function of this liver, but that's not the talk today. Today, we're gonna be measuring what happens to the gallbladder. So there is, I surrounded 5 and 11 because on the image 5, let's see if we can play it back. Okay, on the image 5, you see in green the outline of biliary radicals, and it goes into the duodenum, that's the tubular green structure in frame 5, and in red is the gallbladder. It's pretty clear. But then on image 11, the duodenum and the gallbladder appear to be fused, they're like one. For us to count gallbladder activity, we need to see it separate from the duodenal activity. So if they're overlapping like this in the anterior view, which is how the images were taken, we need to do something about that. So what we do, this is the anterior view. As you can see, that red in the gallbladder and duodenum is behind it. They're projecting on top of one another. So if we do something different and reorient that camera to the left, so we will start taking pictures from the left side, left anterior oblique at approximately 40 degree angle, and bring the gamma camera that way, now they can be projecting separate. That's how we should be looking at the gallbladder separate from the duodenum, so we can count it, not counting the two things together, but one at a time. So if we image it in that way, now you see the gallbladder and the duodenum separately. So that's another good trick, little pearl, that, you know, if you don't see it on your images, it might be then in your radiology department, they haven't caught up with this little trick, and you might want to teach them along with why nuclear medicine is called nuclear medicine. So they need to be taken at an LAO, left anterior oblique projection. Now, I happen to be part of this study, which was a pivotal study defining normal values and what kind of an infusion of syncolite or CCK is the most helpful. And that study basically showed, and here are three infusion rates. If you look on your left-hand side, you will see the 15/0.02. 15 corresponds to the time of infusion, 15 minutes, and 0.02 is the micrograms of syncolite, or CCK, per kilogram of patient's body weight. So on the top panel, 15/0.02, you see that ejection fraction, which is the next column, was 56.9, or say 57, let's round it off, plus or minus about 30. So that's a large swing. If you take two standard deviations, you can see that the range would be anywhere from -2 to 98%. This is actual measured range in those normal volunteers. Once again, those are totally normal volunteers. If you infuse it over 30 minutes, which is the next line down, you will see that that range shrinks down a little bit to from 8 to 99. And if you infuse it over 60 minutes, which is yet another line down, you see that the range becomes a little more narrow and workable if you want to figure out what's abnormal. You can't tell what's abnormal if it can range anywhere from, you know, from almost a minus to 98%. It's anything, anything goes. But if it's from 38 to 100, as when you infuse over 60 minutes, well, if it's, for example, 20, that's below normal range, and it's pretty clear. So that's how we came up with normal range and how to infuse syncolite. Please check with your radiology department. Make sure that they infuse syncolite, which is the synthetic CCK, over 60 minutes, not anything much shorter than that. Will not work. And the reason it won't work, it's not supposed to work. Even normal people have abnormal ejection fractions with that kind of an infusion. So a lot of folks that will be sent to surgery would be actually normal folks. And as you see, gallbladder ejection fraction traditionally for decades has been used with all kinds of infusions. The infusion rates were different from hospital to hospital, all over the place, and still are today. So one useful thing that you can do is to go down and see what they do. It could be on a film as well that you get on your PACS or picture archiving system. And I don't know what you use, but you should be able to see the images. And it's very useful to know whether or not your folks providing you with good studies. So if you look there, if you infuse over 15 minutes, and use 35% as your threshold, one, two, three, the fourth column shows you that 15-minute infusion, 16 out of 60 normal actually registered as abnormal, and those were totally normal volunteers. So you get 27% false positive rate. So out of 100 patients, 27 you would be sending to surgery needlessly. They don't have gallbladder dysfunction. If your folks in radiology infuse it over 30 minutes, about 10%, so every one out of 10 patients you send with abnormal ejection fraction actually have a normal gallbladder. And I think you would care about that. You would care to know. So here is that same very patient that I showed you, you know, the first 60 minutes. And here is the 60-minute infusion. And you can see the gallbladder contracts very, very quickly. So that black ball empties out, and you can see it empties into the small bowel, as it should, right? So it empties into the duodenal C-loop, crosses the midline, goes to the patient's left side, and then wiggles around, and that's the small bowel pattern. And then we circle the gallbladder. As I said, everything is relative in nuclear medicine, so activity can be measured using regions of interest. Those regions of interest are in green, and if you apply them, then you can measure, relatively speaking, the ejection fraction of the gallbladder. So, in this particular patient, the ejection fraction was in, I don't know why it didn't show here, but it was in 90s, something like 98% ejection fraction. That's totally normal. So the normal ejection fraction, that's easy. You say normal ejection fraction, normal study, if everything else looks normal. But what if you have a patient with gallstones? Is that useful then? So 45-year-old female with several years of abdominal pain, most severe right upper quadrant cramps and diarrhea, and you see the images, ultrasound, the lower and on top is the CT showing bunch of stones laden gallbladder. How many of you would think that the hepatobiliary scintigraphy with ejection fraction would be helpful here? Let's have a show of hands. Okay, so it would be helpful. How many of you think that the hepatobiliary imaging with gallbladder ejection fraction would not be helpful here? Well, let me ask you differently. How many of you think that giving CCK or syncolide would be actually dangerous? What if you dislodge that stone and put it in the common bile duct or obstruct the cystic duct causing acute cholecystitis? How many of you would worry about that? Okay, well, good to see, good to see. So, interestingly, for those who worry that you would cause the stone to dislodge, let me say this. How often do you tell your patient not to stop by nearby McDonald's for a Big Mac? I mean, the Big Mac probably will elicit just as much syncolite, or CCK rather, I should say, as what we would give in the laboratory. So not sending this patient for hepatobiliary scintigraphy would be similar as you would worry about patient with potential coronary disease, or with coronary disease, sending the patient for a stress test. What if they occlude the plaque, you know, rupture, you know, and you cause them having an infarct? But we do send patients. And the reason we do is because it's going to be under controlled circumstances. There are going to be physicians around. So if that patient were to get into trouble, wouldn't you rather have that patient get into trouble in a quality place with physicians around? I would. That's why we send them for stress tests. So if you want, you can think of it as the gallbladder stress test. However, unlike a stress test for coronary disease, it doesn't produce nearly as much complications as does the actual stress test, physical stress test. We see no, and I've practiced for nearly 30 years now, and I have not seen one single patient that we caused either acute cholecystitis. Some patients, about 15%, might have a very intermittent fleeting pain, but they have pain, intermittent fleeting, every day. So, and then we at least be able to say whether or not it's relevant to their gallbladder pathology. So let's see what happens here. Here's the first image supposed to be here. Let's get straight to the bottom of it. The first image for some reason is not showing, but here is the gallbladder. It did fill. So sometimes patients with chronic cholecystitis and stones would not fill with radioactivity their gallbladder. And that is abnormal in and of itself. So that gallbladder probably is better be out because it doesn't function properly. Every gallbladder in a normal person will fill, if patient is properly prepared, within 60 minutes. Every one of us will fill within 60 minutes, given that we hopefully are all normal. This is the patient, the same one with those CT and ultrasound that got the infusion, and we got 88% ejection fraction. This patient actually ended up having irritable bowel syndrome. And if you look at that image, you see that that patient, the blackest portion of the gut activity is actually colon. We rarely, if ever, see colon. And this patient has a very rapid transit through the bowel all the way into the colon because has irritable bowel syndrome and was treated for and considered to have gallbladder dysfunction and was just checked before being sent for surgery. The trouble is, surgery could be good, but for a good reason. And this patient would have had the same pain after the surgery, I can guarantee you that. So it's better to treat the patient for the right thing than act on anatomical finding of stones. It's simply just like you following the report of a radiologist that the spine appears without any significant findings. And on your manipulative treatment, you certainly know very, very different from that. How much time do I have left, Jim? Do you know?
Maybe 2 minutes?
Maybe for 2 minutes, I can have folks, I have a bunch of very interesting cases. I knew I'm not gonna get through them all. I hardly actually touched on the surface. Maybe we can meet again next year or whenever you have your conference, and maybe we can have a little longer session, and then we can really get into it. But I feel that I'm gonna leave you with something to take home today and look at what comes back if you order this test and how to improve what you are getting. Maybe a conversation with your radiologist will be in order. There are still a lot of practices that do it very, very different. With that, I would like to open the floor for discussion or any questions that you might have. Please, the mics should be active at the front. If you would like, please come up and ask me a question. Everything you wanted to know about nuclear medicine, but you were afraid to ask before, please do now. Well, this is one of the most clear presentations. There's no questions left. How about that, Jim? I guess I've done my job all right. Well, thank you. You've been a wonderful audience.